Greetings, my friends. This is Mark Foster chatting with you from my Whitefish location with another episode of Newport Legacy Insights. I'm representing our Newport Beach UBS team, Newport Legacy Partners. Today, I'm very fortunate to have Kurt Ryman as my guest speaker. Kurt is the head of Global Wealth Management Fixed Income Research for UBS. Although his focus is actually fixed income, he is a great resource for insights on government policy. I'm going to add him into the call a little bit later, but first I wanted to explain how I got connected with Kurt and why I asked him to join us today. I was chatting with my good buddy, John Woolishin, who is also with UBS Research. And I mentioned to John that I was struggling to come up with a relevant topic for this month's recording. I mentioned that from my perspective, the most significant issues de jure, as it were, is pretty much the AI story. And would that create a larger divide in this developing K-shaped economy? For reference, a K-shaped economy is one where part of society is on an upward trajectory. Should be easy to say, right? Upward trajectory, those being the capital owners, versus the labor class who feel opportunity is basically eroding. This is creating the unaffordability issue that we're experiencing today. I told John about an odd interaction that I had with a young man who was expressing his frustration with the baby boom generation. There's this brewing generational conflict. The gist of it is the younger generation is clearly disgruntled. You know, I went on AI on Microsoft Copilot to ask, what is the intergenerational issue going on? And they say there's three primary issues at hand. You could probably guess them all, but the first being housing costs, student loan debt, and wage stagnation. So I want to make a few comments on each of these. You know, I'm quite the baby boomer, and I'm sure the other guys in the team who are not can have a retort, but nonetheless, here we go. Regarding housing, during the baby boom era,
when they hit home buying age, inflation was through the roof and interest rates were extremely elevated.
That made buying houses really, really tough because mortgages were something like 18%. With that extreme high cost of financing, asset prices were really low. It's just like other things like stocks. When interest rates are through the roof, the stock market's way down. So stocks had single-digit PE ratios. And when interest rates are way up, the value of housing is way down too. Oddly, with prices low and interest rates high, the cost to carry to buy a home for a baby boomer was pretty much the same then as it is now. That said, eventually, inflation eased, interest rates cracked, they came down. And because of that, asset values go up and the baby boomers enjoyed the rising value of their houses and the rising value of the stock market. So really, it's a function of inflation and interest rates. Nonetheless, carrying costs then is pretty much the same as the carrying costs now. Regarding education costs, in the boomers' years, only one in four boomers got a college education. For the Gen Zers, it's about 4 in 10 that got a college education. So there's this dramatic increase in demand for education, which was pretty much supported by unlimited government lending, you know, the student loans. Given the excessive demand and the government money, the education system ran up the cost by about 3 times the rate of inflation. So poor public policy coupled with some unrealistic expectations, in essence, drove the cost of education absolutely through the roof. Regarding the issue of wage stagnation, I believe this could be a function of the last 4 to 5 decades of globalization, shipping our high-cost labor jobs overseas, this creating a global homogenization, in essence, of labor costs at the expense of the lower class and middle class jobs in the United States. From all that to our current K economy, the resentment against the older generation, as well as the resentment against the rich, the up-and-coming wealth tax in California, the new taxes in the state of Washington, the new taxes in New York, that pied-à-terre tax in New York City. You know, what basically is happening? Is there a class war bubbling up? This morning, I was watching CNBC, and the commentators were down in Washington, D.C. So they had a steady stream of politicians that are dying to get in front of a camera and a microphone. So they had Elizabeth Warren on, and she talked about her concept that she's been pitching, a wealth tax, which is basically, she says it's only 2 cents. You know, a billionaire can afford 2 cents. Why don't they give 2 cents? So let me just explain that, because even Renda asked me, you know, what's this idea about giving 2 cents? It makes no sense. Well, what she's talking about, Elizabeth Warren, that is, she wants every year anybody that has more than $50 million to give 2 cents out of every dollar in wealth that they have. So let me just walk you through the math, because, you know, the idea of giving 2 cents really sounds like no big deal, right? But so let's say that we'll just use someone that has $100 million because it makes the math really simple. So let's say this individual with $100 million sticks all of their money in 10-year treasury bonds because they're uber patriotic, and they have all their money in the United States government treasuries because they're conservative. So a U.S. treasury pays just a little bit above 4%. So that individual who's worth $100 million earns, say, $4.25 million. And the state of California, right out of the blocks, the federal and state tax is about $2,250,000. So they're paying a little more than half in taxes to begin with. So they pay $2.25 million in income tax. And then you have the Elizabeth Warren wealth tax, which is another 2 cents on every dollar. Well, 2 cents on every dollar for $100 million is $2 million. So for all intents and purposes, her tax would kick in at a wealth level of $50 million. So what she's really saying is, once you hit a wealth of $50 million, you should have to pay the government 100% of everything you make going forward. You know, how do you think that would affect the economy? In essence, everyone worth $50 million, I mean, that's as rich as you can get in the United States, according to Elizabeth Warren. Chatting with John Wolishin said, you know, you got to call Kurt Ryman. He is, like I said, the head of UBS Wealth Management Fixed Income, but he's also kind of a public policy wonk, and he can speak to these issues. So I need to get him on. So without further ado, let's bring Kurt into this discussion. Kurt, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate you. I appreciate all of your thoughtful commentary and, you know, the time you spent with me last week talking about this call.
It was a great chat, Mark, and so I'm delighted to be on your podcast, and thanks so much for the invitation.
Oh my God, thanks. Thank you, Kurt. I really did enjoy that conversation last week where we talked about several topics, and I give a little rundown for those listening. You know, we started talking about the California wealth tax, and then we started talking about the long-term solvency issue of California and maybe other states, and then we talked about the K-shaped economy, and we talked about the last 50 years of globalization effects on the labor class, and we talked about political dysfunction, we talked about the low birth rate, we talked about immigration in a standstill, and we talked about AI and its long-term effect. You made the point at the very end that you see like this optimistic opportunity, which kind of surprised me a little bit that you had that comment, but I think that's great. So let's see if we can kind of unpack what we talked about last week for all of our listeners. And I know there's a lot.
Let's see if we can repeat it.
Yeah. I mean, you can go in a lot of different directions, that's for sure. Just to start, what's happening here at the state level? There seems to be this tax the rich class conflict or something like that going on in our state. What's causing that? What do you think's going on?
It's probably multifaceted, and I don't think this is not new. It's something that we could say has been talked about for decades, but it is starting to reach a crescendo. And like you're seeing it, was approved on the referendum in California. It's very much part of what was on the ballot in New York City. Other states are moving in this direction. We're still awaiting for this wealth or more progressive income tax to appear. It has its downsides. We can get into that. But the basic nature of it is states are under pressure to meet budget shortfalls. And it's not like their credit rating or their finances today are difficult. They're managing to plug holes and do the needed math to get things to even out. But what's coming down the path is stemming from the 2025 legislation that did cut taxes, and that has been undeniably good for, I mean, we're living through it right now. The cuts in taxes on an individual and corporate level can explain a lot of the economic activity that's happening today, despite high oil prices, despite the tariffs that were passed and came through last year. Consumers are spending, the economy is strong. But not only did they cut taxes, they cut spending. And those spending cuts are going to start to kick in next year, in 2027. Cuts to Medicaid, cuts to food assistance programs. Many of these are operated out of the state. So how are you going to plug that gap? And then there are other things that we could talk about that's more speculative, but I look at household net worth relative to GDP as in one indicator, and that is off the charts. Like, the wealth that's been accrued in the U.S. has far outpaced economic output. It's not a bad thing. I mean, at least I don't see that as a negative. You know, that's intergenerational, right? That's something that can help to cure a lot of ills. But some might be looking at that and saying, this is a ripe source for taxing.
Can I make a comment on that? Well, first off, two comments. One is, you said that the states, I don't think that people caught that you suggested that the spending by the federal government's going to go down, but that hole had to be filled by the states. So in essence, states are going to have to pay more because of the changes in food assistance and Medicare or Medicaid or whatever. So states have to pay more. So in essence, they're trying to figure out where they can get some additional money.
Right. And those haven't been enacted yet, but they're coming.
Yeah.
And so they have to prepare for that. And states don't have to implement taxes to recover that. They could also cut spending.
Yeah.
But they don't want to do that because that's also not politically palatable. So it's a combination of bad choices that policymakers face as a result of some of the decisions that are happening at the federal level.
Let me make a comment about, you know, you said that the net worths of everybody's going up through the roof. You know, we got in a discussion about this within our team. You know, my sense is nobody looks long-term enough. In the long run, you look at this immense wealth. Country's been around a long time and will be around a long time. And you look at a lot of these billionaires who are in their 60s or 70s or some are in their 30s, I guess. But I mean, ultimately, they're dead, and the government gets 40% of everything they created. And even if they set up trusts to give it to charity or whatever else, I mean, that is a bunch of money that's coming into the system that's going to the government or going to, you know, other needy sources. So if we really look a little longer term, having our nation richer is actually not a bad thing. It's a good thing. But it, you know, leads me into the second question. As everyone gets a little bit richer, they become a little more self-aware of what they're paying in taxes. And in the United States, we have a pretty mobile society. Is this potentially a challenge for states like California if people ultimately vote with their feet and your tax base gets eroded?
Yeah, that's something that they have to concern themselves with, because the job creation that creates the wealth and the investment that goes together with that could end up leaving the state. It's a short-term fix that creates potentially long-term problems. It's a balancing act, and you have to get that right. If you make the tax impairment too high relative to neighboring states or other jurisdictions that people may be just as comfortable living, then it does act as a drag. And you do see that, like, you hear, for example, brain drain from Canada, let's say, where tax rates are a lot higher. Social services, meaning the kind of the net that catches you if you were to lose your job in Canada is higher than it is in the US. But there's been a multi-decade period of subpar business investment in Canada. AI was, by many accounts, I think I've got this right, invented at the University of Toronto. You do not hear much about AI leadership in Canada. So it's the same thing. If you have mobile labor and tax rates are high in one jurisdiction, you'll move to the lower tax rate. We are all, you know, we are all income maximizers in the end. So there is that dilemma that policymakers have to be careful not to overcorrect.
It's ironic that AI was developed in the University of Toronto. I mean, that's just absolutely crazy.
I think I've got that right.
That's just amazing. Okay. You know, in our conversation, we talked about this has been kind of a long-term coming, you know, this growing, this K-shaped economy. And, you know, you have all these, I mentioned earlier in the call that out of the Gen Zers, 40% of them got a college degree. A lot of these highly educated individuals ended up no choice but to become baristas, in essence, and suffering with all their debt. Last week, we talked about this 40 to 50 year process of globalization and all of the offshoring that pretty much took all the high-paying union jobs with them. Do you see this as one of the reasons that we're experiencing this K economy, or is it just not that significant?
I think it's a huge underappreciated issue that Americans would be wise to learn from, because globalization, we think about it as like, oh, well, companies just decided at one point that they wanted factories in China. That's not what happened. There were certain international, like WTO and other kind of liberal economic theories that supported the notion of integration, but you had to have a shrinking of space and time through advancements in technology, importantly, the internet, to be able to have that instant communication and to be able to really just cheaply trade information about supply chains and manufacturing processes. And the more the production moved to a computer that could communicate, the easier you could facilitate this. But the problem is that the loss of these jobs because of technology, and I say this specifically because we're going through this now, like this whole idea of losing jobs as a result of technology is very much a current theme around the advancement of artificial intelligence. My opinion is that policymakers got it wrong in the era of globalization. Broadly speaking, a lot of people benefited.
Yeah.
You know, you lifted billions of people out of poverty in China and India, and you made a number of people more wealthy in the United States. What didn't happen, and by the way, this is in every single international economics textbook ever written, is that there are gains from trade, but if you want it to be sustainable, you have to redistribute from those that win to those who lose. We didn't redistribute to those who lost, at least not sufficiently, and it's also very difficult. It's, you know, easy in theory. In practice, what are you going to do? Like, what is the job training look like? Or how can you move somebody who lost their job as a factory worker to become Uber programmer in San Francisco? It's not as easy. Like, they're just... But the problem is you have community decay and a feeling that your kids' futures were going to be worse than yours, you know, and the data bears it out. So getting that right when you have a massive technological change that alters the worker's relationship with their job, or where jobs are completely, when they just disintegrate, is really important for society to get that right. Because if you don't get that right, then you end up with, you know, a lot of populist outcomes that can end up hollowing out the very fabric and the foundation on which this economic output is being created.
Historically, I'd always said, if I were king of the country, that I would always want my labor force to be as highly educated as possible. As a baby boomer parent, of course you want your kids to go to college and be more prepared than you were for the whatever comes in the future. I guess the baby boomers made a mistake in that regard. We overwhelmed the college system with all of these additional kids, and the price of college went through the friggin' roof. The assumption is you have to go to college to get a job. You borrow all this money, you create all this debt, and then all these jobs are gone. That maybe we should have had more vocational type training, because now we got a society of highly educated people that don't have the ability to change a flat tire. So it's
the heck? Those practical skills are really important. It's just, there's so many things that come from this that I sort of am paralyzed in being able to want to address them all at once. But debt is fixed, asset prices fluctuate, and debt can grow in time if you don't have an income source, because you then take on other forms of debt just to keep your lifestyle going.
So you get buried.
And it becomes this.
Yeah.
Exactly. I have family members who ended up in that circumstance. My brother-in-law, meanwhile, he's a welder in a salt mine in Western New York. This notion that you can have a skill without a college degree is something that I think is beginning to catch on. And by the way, he's also one of the smartest people I know. It's not about intelligence. It's about practical skills being used in the economy. And I think this focus now on the importance of skills for national economic security and national preparedness is something that kind of lose in the era of globalization. And the idea of bringing that back, it goes right at the heart of what you were talking about, is it a skills-based education? Is it a humanities-based education? Is it a STEM? It's all of the above. You can't focus on one at the expense of the other and expect to have a rigorous,
balanced society. Yeah. So trying to pick the fly poop out of the peppercorn, in essence, is there any possibility that this COVID created a unique awareness where we saw the dysfunction of the supply chain risks, you know, and the frustration with the labor force too? You see people looking inwards more, and you have, you know, a couple decades of reshoring. I mean, you're seeing it. It seems they've been talking about it here in the United States, and it seems like, you know, you're seeing the same thing potentially in Europe. Could that actually get some traction, and could that actually have a positive effect on GDP growth?
If there is going to be reshoring, it has to be done in a way that's thoughtful and is targeted to the industries that we, for maybe national security reasons or general economic security reasons, we prioritize. And there are different ways of going about that. Tariffs could be one. Voluntary export restraints was something that we used in the 1980s around semiconductors. There can be international efforts to try to manage the surplus production that comes out of certain countries in order to maintain balanced supply and demand, so that you're not forcing companies to compete with really cheap inputs that are subsidized, because that's a different economic model. But having a broad brush protectionist agenda ends up with the U.S. trying to compete on manufacturing iPhones and sneakers, which is not something that I think even if an American is without a job, they may not want to do those jobs. So we have to be intelligent about how we design whatever barriers to trade or whatever efforts we might undertake internationally to try to sort of harden, I guess, our supply chains. But yeah, they were exposed for sure during the pandemic, although, you know, some of that was just pandemic. And you're never going to go to what economists call the state of autarky, where you have a closed economy and you're producing everything. So that means that even in the next pandemic, there's going to be stuff that you're just going to be without. But the lesson maybe that Europe learned over the war in Ukraine is important, and we're learning it again with the war in Iran, which is energy security, something that the U.S. invested in all throughout the late 2000s and into the next decade has paid dividends. We're not energy independent by any stretch, but compared to other economies, other developed economies, the U.S. is in a much more secure position. And these are some of the things that I guess I was trying to point to when we were talking last week about there are reasons to be optimistic. I think too often we only compare ourselves to ourselves, but we don't do enough to think about what's our standing, what's unique about the United States, perhaps maybe exceptional. And it still strikes me on a number of fronts that the U.S. is in a pretty strong position.
I don't want to belabor that onshoring discussion, but the whole AI data center build out, it seems like there's some resurgence in manufacturing in the United States. The UBS perspective is ultimately interest rates come down, but it seems like this reindustrialization would elevate growth, but it would also elevate inflation to a certain extent since there's more demand for general real estate, construction, raw materials, et cetera. How do you think this plays out in terms of inflation? And are you, like UBS, wedded to the idea that ultimately rates come down?
I would say that on the 10-year at 4.5%, the risks are that it could go up and down. I'm speaking out of both sides of my mouth here, but what I want to say is that there's risks of volatility, and it's especially around the uncertainty over the end of the Iraq war and the timing of that, and whether we get a full reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, how long that takes is really critical. There are some concerns, I would say, about the labor market with some potential shortages. You know, you had a pretty sudden drop in immigration, but at the same time, you have people who are retiring, and so the participation rate is dropping, and you're bringing in artificial intelligence, which is productivity enhancing, ideally. So there's just a large confluence of factors. We think that inflation is likely to be moving lower, not higher, over the balance of the year. But one piece of that that's really important is that the labor market is not as hot as it's been in the recent months. So if we don't see the weakening in the job market, and I don't mean recession, I just mean like just not as red hot, then the odds of inflation turning down, the odds of the Fed cutting rates are lower, then bond yields could end up not moving down as our forecast is suggesting.
Well, it does seem inflation has been, unemployment has been bizarrely stable. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's going lower, doesn't seem like it's going higher. Wage inflation has been reasonable. You know, actually, if you think about it, if there's supposed to be benefits of AI and low unemployment, you would expect wage growth to be a little better. But everything has been surprisingly stable. I would think that that's a pretty darn good thing. If unemployment does start to rise, do you think that gets blamed on a potential weaker economy or AI effects?
If the unemployment rate starts to rise, is more than likely, as I'm thinking about it, that the beneficial effects of the tax cuts that have been supporting consumption here in the first half of 2026 start to fade, and that the oil price rise, the gas price you're paying at the tank, maybe there's also been some, you know, use of credit to maintain lifestyles. If gas prices remain in the high fours or even in the $5 to $6 range, then I think you start talking about the consumer retrenching, that the lower end of the K really starting to have problems. And that can start to feed into demand for workers. I don't know that it's necessarily an AI-driven phenomenon just yet. I wouldn't rule it out. Right now, companies, and I don't mean AI companies, I just mean everyday companies are racing to figure out how to improve margins and grow earnings by becoming nimbler and more efficient through the use of AI. But we also know that there are these institutional frictions that companies face to moving too fast. And so it's reasonable to expect some moderation in job demand because of the productivity benefits, and it's going to take some time for AI to develop the new jobs and for people to have the skills to do the new jobs down the road, whatever those may be.
Right.
We're not
right.
very good, by the way, at thinking about those things. But
no.
I think initially, if the job market were to slow just over this next horizon, end of the year, early 2027, it's just the consumer starts to get some fatigue, and that shows up in less aggregate demand. And it's part of our reasoning why inflation does end up moving lower, because you're having a hard time building out the supply side. Well, then, you know, moderate the demand side. And that's probably what we're likely to see.
With these changing technologies, new jobs that get created almost get created from the bottom up instead of the top down. It's like people become functional with a certain technology, come up with ideas, and they bring it to the market instead of corporations that have been doing things the same way for a million years. All of a sudden think, you know, the light bulb goes on and they could do something different. You know, this whole gig economy, I mean, it has some degree of significance, and that sure wasn't created from the top down.
Do you have time for me to go off on a little bit of a detour that's
sure.
connected to this?
Yeah. Go for it.
Okay. So, because you said light bulb, and we've been doing this report series at UBS over the last 8 months. We started it 250 days before July 4th of this year. We started it last year. And the point was to have a series that focused on US innovation with a little bit of a patriotic flair, you know, something to kind of change a little bit the narrative, focus on the good things. And I've had a lot of fun with this. If you're a history buff, you're going to love it. But the first report was on the Transcontinental Railroad. The second one was on electrification. The third was on aviation. The fourth was on the assembly line. And we've done eight since then, but I'm going to stop going through each one of them just to make a point.
Yeah.
And that is that electrification in the late 1800s with Thomas Edison and his, you know, initial power plants was what AI today would be, what we would call the infrastructure or the enabling layer. It was the core infrastructure technology. The adoption rate of electricity took decades because the infrastructure build out took a long time. But eventually a guy named Henry Ford comes along and he figures out how to redeploy the assembly line from a steam-driven motor to one that's powered by electrical motors, which were modular and could be moved all around the plant, and totally transformed production. So this is the application layer. This is like today's companies trying to figure out how to use AI. He figured it out. And what he did was the handshake with workers was, you're going to go on this assembly line and you're no longer going to have a specialized skill. You're going to have a routine job. You're going to be unskilled, but you're going to do the same thing all day. And in return for that, I'm going to double your wages and give you an extra day off. And the product that you create is going to become so cheap that you're going to be able to own it. So the luxury good becomes commoditized. I guess if we talk about optimism, and this is the one area where I'm still kind of wondering, are the companies that are creating the new technology, the application layer today, wondering how are they going to create the consumer that buys the product? Is that part of their thinking? Like, do they worry about that? Do they wonder, is it part of their plan? Or is the plan to grow margins and earnings and basically like feed the gains to capital over labor?
Well, it'll be a combination of both, won't it? I mean, I've been using AI for such a short period of time, but instantly I feel like I'm dependent on it.
I'm hopeful, but the piece of it, which is really difficult, is to know what the jobs of the future are going to be around AI. Just like Henry Ford probably, you know, maybe he did, maybe he didn't, you know, envision what the world would need in terms of like Department of Motor Vehicle workers,
yeah,
you know, and like auto repair shops and gas stations everywhere and all the jobs that flowed from that. Today's technology, we don't know what the new jobs will be, what the training is going to be needed for those. But, you know, you can remain hopeful that that will emerge. But there is this question.
It has to. It'll just leverage human effort. I mean, it should raise growth and raise productivity and raise per capita GDP. We just need to do it in a way that everybody is tide rises all boats. Yeah.
Right. take a look at the series if you're interested.
Yeah, no, it sounds good.
It's available on UBS.com.
Yeah, and I assume that's something I can send out to people listening on the podcast if they have an interest. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So this has been going on for a little while. Usually we go about a half hour, so we're well past that. If you were me, can you think of any questions you would ask you to close out this conversation? No.
Yeah. So I
okay. Yeah, go on.
No, that kind of stumped me a little bit. And I usually am one of these people who tries to sometimes, you know, figure out what is the best one. But what I want to know is, will the AI investment that's taking place today be able to generate the return on an investment in a sufficient amount of time? Because the investment that was projected at the start of the year was already well below the pace that they're at now. And as we all know from past periods of overinvestment, like the financial crisis and dot-com era, you know, you do have to make sure that you get a return on that invested capital.
So you got to assume there's going to be a lot of train wrecks. It's like if you're out duck hunting and something's flying away and you take a shot, even if you get your bird, the majority of the shot misses. So you may have success, but you have a lot of failure in the process too.
I'm so excited. Two of my favorite jokes in the world involve ducks. So I'm looking forward to sharing those with you at some point.
That would be great. And it's a good time to kind of round this up. All I can say is I hope you get to enjoy the beautiful area in Vermont, like I'm enjoying this beautiful area in Whitefish. And I hope you get to do it sooner at a lower age than I did here. So
thanks very much.
Yeah, Mike. And thanks
so
much.
That would be a blessing.
Yeah, that would be. That'd be a wonderful change in life. So, hey, thank you so much, Kurt. I really appreciate you as a friend and for helping out today on this call. You're awesome.
Likewise. Thank you.
Okay, everybody. Thank you so much for listening in on another episode of Newport Legacy Partners Podcast. And it's a pleasure having the ability to chat with everybody all the time. Thank you so much. Bye-bye for now.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.